Hi everyone, welcome back to Dhamma Threads. I'm Bhante Sujato and we're here to discuss the suttas with a group of friends and to specifically talk about the discourse on right view, Samaditti Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 9. We'll be reading from Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's wonderful translation in his middle-length discourses of the Buddha. We've so far discussed the first few sections of the sutta dealing with the ways of right action, the 10 paths of right action and wrong action, and also the one dealing with the 4 aharas, or nutriments. So today we're going to move on to discuss the section dealing with the 4 noble truths. So we'll follow the same format we've used in previous sessions, and we'll begin by reading through the section, and then we'll have some discussion about it. So the section follows a similar format as we've seen before. Venerable Sariputta has just finished the previous section and the monks respond by saying, "Good friend," the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they ask him a further question. "But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma?" Sariputta replied, "There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma." And Sariputta goes on to say, "And what is suffering? What is the origin of suffering? What is the cessation of suffering? What is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the 5 aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. This is called suffering. And what is the origin of suffering? It is craving which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that. That is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of suffering. And what is the cessation of suffering? It's the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of suffering. And what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. This is called the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When a noble disciple has thus understood suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, "I am." And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So the passage rounds up with the same closing passage as we've seen previously. And the main difference here is the introduction of the topic, the 4 Noble Truths, which we've seen talked about previously. We've seen the 4 Noble Truths, the pattern of the 4 Noble Truths used in the context of the 4 Aharas. Right? This also talks about the Aharas, the origin of them, the ending of them, and the way leading to the ending of them. So this pattern that the 4 Noble Truths uses can be applied in many different contexts and is applied in many different contexts in the suttas. Apparently, it originally derives from medicine. This is what they say, is that it was a medical diagnostic method, right? So you identify what is the illness, you look at the cause of the illness, then you identify, well, what is the state of health, right? What is it, where are we aiming for? And then you work out a prescription, a medicine or program to get to that state. So it can be applied in many different contexts. Of course, the main place we see this pattern applied is in the Four Noble Truths themselves, where the topic is suffering. And, of course, the question of suffering is absolutely central to the Buddha's dispensation. And to me, this is one of the most fantastic things about the Dhamma. Like when I first encountered the Dhamma, You know, I came from a Christian background or a Catholic background, and in that background, that we always have a problem, what they call the problem of evil. I kind of don't want to go too much into the theology of it here, but the problem of evil essentially says, if God is good, how come he created a world where there's so much suffering, right? Now, you can have a lot of arguments back and forth about that, but ultimately, I believe that argument is insurmountable. I think it's inconceivable that a good God would have created a world with this much suffering. When we come to Buddhism, of course, that's not a problem we have to explain away. It's the very essence of what it's all about. We begin with that question of suffering. Right? So to many people, of course, it's very depressing. Buddhism is depressing religion. Oh, always banging on about suffering, so on and so forth. I remember I had this interfaith dialogue once with this Christian who made that point, and he said, "Oh, you Buddhists are always obsessing about suffering." And I'm like, "Well, actually, you might have noticed that our icon is like a happy man sitting peacefully with a smile on his face. And what does your icon represent?" Yeah. If we're talking about what is suffering and what isn't suffering, the Buddha was talking about the way to the ending of suffering. Yeah? So that's we're not obsessing about it. We're recognizing it as a reality. Yeah. When we begin our Buddhist practice, we need to start by discussing that problem and identifying what the actual nature of suffering is. One of the tendencies of the human mind is to we tend to be very limited and quite narrow in our focus. So we tend to be quite, we see this suffering and that suffering, right? This itch or this bad food or this something that I don't want, right? And we get upset and concerned about that. And in fact, of course, there's many, many, many other kinds of suffering in the world which we're not facing or not addressing. And so one of the purposes of Dhamma practice is to try to get some kind of perspective on suffering. I always remember a simile that Ajahn Chah gave, or I heard anyway, that Ajahn Chah had given somebody who was doing like palliative care, looking after people while they were dying. And he said, is that a good thing to do to try to bring the Dhamma? He said, yeah, it's a good thing to do. He said, it's like somebody standing up to their waist in a stream of lava and you give them a lolly and say, here, this will take your mind off it. So yeah, it's a good thing to give them a lolly because you know, it's better than not having one. So when we begin to sort of really understand the full dimension of suffering, yeah, we begin to get an idea of the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things is that we shy away from it. Yeah, we're not capable of really responding and appreciating the scope of the problem. Mm-hmm. And because we're not able to do that, we're not able to solve the problem, right? We're in denial. Yeah? So one of the techniques which the Buddha used in making this possible, because the Buddha, of course, is a master psychologist, right? So he wouldn't begin his teaching by talking about the Four Noble Truths, right? If you look at the classic way the teaching goes, it ends with the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, right? And everything is leading you up to that teaching a little bit by little bit by little bit, and raising your mind up and making your mind clear and bright and happy. And when you feel happy and content and inspired, then you're ready to hear those deep and hard truths. Yeah. So if we're struggling with that and we're thinking that it's pessimistic and so on, then just don't worry about it too much. Yeah. Just be happy. Just relax. Yeah, suffering will still be there when you get back to it. So in order to be able to take on board this teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and to really appreciate it without resisting and without denying it, without minimizing the problem, we need to be happy. Right? And so that's why the Buddhist meditation is always leading towards peace, towards happiness and so on. Make you as relaxed and happy. Oh, I feel so nice, everything. And then boom, that's when we that's when we land the Four Noble Truths on. Yeah? So the Four Noble Truths, even though they can be difficult to really take on board in their fullness, but when we really understand them, then of course they lead to an even much deeper sense of letting go and happiness, because we're letting go of the very root causes of suffering rather than just letting go of the symptoms of things. For example, in one sutta, he picked up 7 little lumps of earth and said, which is greater, the earth in these 7 little lumps, or the earth in the great Himalayan mountains. And the monks, being intelligent and wise people, said the Himalayas are biggest. They did their studies and the surveys and worked out, yes, the Himalayas are biggest, bigger. And the Buddha said, well, this is as much suffering as a stream enterer has. Yeah? Only 7 more lifetimes. There's a little bit of suffering in them. Yeah, and that's the suffering that the stream enterer has let go of. Yeah. So, yeah, it's very powerful stuff. Suffering, I think, reasonably covers the range. I know some people don't like it. I think it's more, frankly, they need to be more, bit more relaxed and happy, and then they'll say, interesting, when some people, oh, it's like stress, or it's like dissatisfaction, or something like that. But these are all too sophisticated. Yeah, dukkha isn't just stress, right? I mean, if you're having your head chopped off, you know, it's not stress, right? If you're suffering from a terminal illness, you don't say, I'm feeling dissatisfied, right? And I remember, all of these kinds of arguments, and I remember the first time that someone put this very clearly. I was listening to a Dhamma talk by Ajahn Brahm many years ago, and he said, actually dukkha is just suffering, yeah? Dukkha, 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 suffering, suffering, suffering. And Ajahn Brahm's the happiest person I know, right? And so because he's so happy, it's not a problem for him, it's suffering. He knows that's what it is. Yeah. Now, you always think, oh, I'll go to the movie and it'll be such a great time, it'll be really fun, I'll really enjoy it and stuff like that. So if it's so enjoyable, why do you need to eat popcorn? Well, the reality is that actually it's not all that enjoyable. It's actually a bit kind of boring and it's a bit predictable and stuff like that. And you're not really on the edge of your seat the whole time. And you might laugh occasionally, but most of the time, actually, people try everything they can to entertain you, but actually you need to have some popcorn to take away the edge, and that's kind of, we're constantly distracting ourselves because these things are just dukkha. Mm. And it is true that when you encounter the Dhamma, and especially if you do some meditation or something like that, I mean, this is, when we advertise meditation courses, we always say, oh, you come and you'll be happy and you'll be peaceful, it'll be very lovely and so on. And what we don't tell people is that you're going to suffer, but more than the fact that you're going to suffer, just by doing the meditation and sitting still and so on, but also you're going to have a new perception of suffering. And when you go back home, nothing will ever be the same. And you can try to pretend and you can forget for a while, right? But you know in your heart that things are never quite what you thought they were before. So in the Four Noble Truths, if we are just to talk about suffering, then it would get a little bit dreary after a while. I mean, we it's a curious thing, we do tend to like to talk about our suffering a lot, don't we? We kind of like to whinge about our aches and pains and blah, 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 but other people don't like to listen to it very much often. But the Buddha's teaching, I think, is very realistic, and I think it's very empowering because it says that suffering ultimately is not something which is due to an external force, right? It's not due to the government. Okay, well, sometimes it's due to the government. It's not due to God or due to your parents or due to any or the other kind of people that we like to blame, your boss, right? It comes from inside, which, I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that that doesn't mean that those external forms of suffering are not real, okay? They are real and they are important and we need to address them. Some kinds of suffering we need to address at a social level, some kinds at a political level, some kinds at an economic level and so on. And they are real and genuine forms of suffering, but they're not the most profound form of suffering, yeah? And with those external forms of suffering, we can at the most ease them, yeah? If someone's suffering from poverty, then we can, lift them out of poverty, make sure they have enough food and all those kinds of things. So that means their suffering is alleviated, but they're still going to suffer, right? If someone's sick in hospital, we can give them a treatment and make them better. That's fine. They can leave hospital. They don't have that particular intense form of suffering, but they're still going to suffer. So no matter what we do within that sphere, we do what we can. Of course, we do what we can to alleviate suffering, but the experience of the ending of suffering, right? The ending of suffering this incredible possibility, right, which is offered by the Buddha and by our Dhamma practice. It's something that we can experience little bits of every day, right? We can experience little bits of letting go, little bits of happiness, little bits of peace. And the promise of the Buddha is that if you keep on going, you keep on letting go, then those little bits will get bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Until you can finally let go. So even if we haven't experienced that final letting go, at least we know what the little letting goes can feel like. Let's refresh ourselves as to what the phrasing of this is in this particular sutta. So Venerable Sariputta speaking, and what is the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of suffering. So by saying that same craving, obviously is referring to the craving mentioned in the Second Noble Truth, the Yayang Tanha Pono Bhavika, the craving that leads to future rebirth. So it's the remainderless fading away and ceasing of that craving. So of course, one thing which I think is often overlooked is that the way that craving is defined in the Four Noble Truths is quite specific. Yeah, it doesn't mean all kinds of craving. Okay, it's specifically that kind of craving that leads to rebirth, or otherwise the sense craving, craving for existence, craving for annihilation. So, and then people ask things like, you know, well, aren't you craving to listen to Dhamma, or aren't you craving to, you know, do something good or something? That's not counted as that craving that leads to future rebirth. That's the craving that leads to the ending of rebirth, right? That's the kind of karma that leads to the ending of karma, yeah? So we don't have to be afraid that because of our Dhamma practice we're just going to get more attachments, and that doesn't work like that. So the ending of craving, yeah? What does it feel like to experience that? We've all experienced craving, right? We've all experienced what it's like to want something, and we know that there's ultimately a suffering in there, right? There's a lack, there's a deficiency, when you want something, you crave something, there's like a movement, like an instinctual movement that you can't control, that sort of moves towards that. Right? I mean, you can control it in the sense of acting out on it, right? But the actual thing itself, when it comes, is just like this animal urge. And then you're like, oh, you can watch that. And then you can watch it subside. What is it like to feel the ending of craving? Well, there's a number of different things there, right? Yes, when you put down the burden, right, you have a feeling as a response to that, right? And so you actually experience something, right? Now, the person next to you, right, is also carrying a similar burden, right? They also put down the burden, right? They also have a feeling. But the feeling that they have is not exactly the same as the feeling that you've had. Right? In fact, it might be quite a different kind of feeling, right? So, you know, I mean, I like to think about the example of someone who gets out of jail. You know, to me, this is a very profound thing. You know, people get, when you get locked up, it's an incredible. It just changes your life, right? You just, everything is gone, right? You realize what that first time you realize it's freedom. I've never been locked up, but I had my best friend was locked up a number of times, and he always recommended that I go to jail. To learn what that experience was. It says you can never appreciate freedom until you have it taken away from you, and you realize that's it. I can't walk out that door. No, there's guys with guns. They'll shoot me if I do. You know, and so when you get released from jail, what do you feel? So of course, everyone might feel something different. Yeah. Somebody feels elated, somebody else feels relieved, somebody else goes and gets drunk, somebody goes and walks down the beach, somebody goes and reunites with their family, right? Do a million different things. And they have a million different emotions. But there's all something in common, right? Which is the feeling of freedom. Which, can you define it? Can you see it in an fMRI scan? I doubt it. But we all recognize that there is something about that. freedom of nibbana is something which has its own quality, which is obviously far more profound than that. But still, we can experience it little bit by little bit. I mean, this is just one thing which people often say when we're talking about nibbana, is people think, oh, you know, if you think in terms of like God and heaven and things like that, then that's a fairly understandable goal, right? You sort of go there and it's all nice and everything's sort of pleasant and they're playing this harp music and stuff like that. I mean, I would hate it because harp music's all right, but I'd get bored with it after half an hour. But not if Sinsin was in the celestial choir, then I'd be fine, yeah. I could listen to Sinsin singing for the rest of eternity, that would be right. But, you know, you have these ideas, but the problem with those ideas, they're very easy to understand, but they also fall apart pretty quickly, right? If you start taking them seriously and start reflecting on what it means and all of those things, you realise actually this is not the kind of thing, there's no basis to it, right? And actually it's completely ridiculous, really, the more you try to follow it through. Whereas with Nibbana, it's difficult to move your head around, difficult to talk about it even, difficult to think about it, right? But that very difficulty and the fact that it's challenging, I think, is really essential, right? What it means is that because we're talking about the highest goal of the spiritual life, if it's something which is trivial and easy to understand, then we would see the inadequacy of it very, very quickly. So I think with Nibbana, I think the Buddha did a very beautiful job, as always, like he didn't talk about it very much, but he did give us enough information to be clear of what it entails. The most important thing is that Nibbana is the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion, right? So that's really useful, yeah? No greed, no hatred, no delusion. We know what those things are. We know what it means for them to arise. We know what it means for them to end. We maybe don't know from our own experience what it's like for them to end completely, but at least we have some idea what it's like for them to end completely. And we know that when those things are in us, that we have suffering, and when those things are not in us, that suffering ends. Yeah? So to me, that's a really good thing to keep coming back to, that kind of very simple understanding, and not get too worried about the kind of more subtle, more metaphysical explanations of Nibbana, because ultimately I think, you know, you end up just chasing your own tail a lot. I'm not sure how far that can get you. The energy is talked about a lot, and it's one of the most common factors in all the different groups of things that are on the factors of the path. When it's expressed in different ways, energy is found probably more often than anything else. Viryena dukkhamacheti, says in the Sutta Nibbana, it's by means of wirya that we cross over sufferings, cross over dukkha. So yes, definitely wirya is a critical part there. But of course, then the question is, what does it actually mean, right? When it talks about wirya, and wirya means four kinds of right efforts, right? When an unwholesome thought or intention arises, that we recognize it, we let go of it, and we put effort into giving rise to wholesome, yeah. And so it's about that persistence of recognizing and understanding those things. Notice it's going together with mindfulness, which recognizes those things. It's going together with wisdom, which understands what the nature is. Right? It's going together with all the other path factors to be able to sort of constantly move in that direction. So it's not about doing kind of something extreme, but it's about a sense of persistence in what you're doing and recognizing all the time. And again, I think that's the kind of effort which, because it's always combined with the wisdom and with the mindfulness, right, you're always reinforcing it, yeah? And I think this is something that's really important to remember with letting go, is to always reflect on it, remind yourself of it, yeah? And keep on rejoicing in the fact that you've done some letting go, right? We don't appreciate it. Actually, we do bits of letting go all the time, yeah? A bit of an offering to someone, a kind word to someone, a moment when you spend helping someone, when you could have been doing something for yourself, all of those things. And we do those acts of letting go all the time, but we don't notice it, and we don't appreciate it. Yeah? So the more that you call it to mind, remember it, reflect on it, then the more you'll reinforce those tendencies. You need to show yourself this is the cause and this is the effect. This is where I held on and that's where I suffered. This is where I let go and that's where I felt peaceful. Yeah? And you show yourself, remind yourself of that again and again and again. And then you're programming your mind to always look for happiness in letting go rather than looking for happiness in holding on. So right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. And I'll just briefly discuss what each of those are. Obviously, that could be the subject of a whole series of talks in itself, but just very briefly, right view we've been talking about, right? So this is the way that we see things, as seeing things in accordance with the Dhamma. Right intention is, of course, what follows on from that. Yeah. So it's how your mind moves, and especially the intention focuses on what's the overall emotional tone of what we're doing. Okay. So letting go, loving kindness, compassion. Right? So to actually put the Dhamma into practice, how do you move from that understanding of Dhamma that we have to actually apply it in our life? This is a right intention. And so we try to make sure that all of our acts are filled with loving kindness, with compassion, and has the spirit of letting go all the time. Right speech. We also discussed previously with the 10 ways of wholesome action. Right action, we also discuss, the same as in the Dasakusala Kamapata. Right livelihood, interestingly enough, isn't one of the Dasakusala Kamapata, so we haven't discussed that so far. But right livelihood, of course, there being the five wrong kinds of livelihood which the Buddha talks about for lay people. For monastics, there's many kinds of wrong livelihood. In fact, pretty much any kind of way of earning your living is wrong livelihood for monastics, except for going for alms around and getting your food like that and just accepting whatever donations are freely offered. That's right livelihood for the monks and nuns. For lay people, of course, many kinds of right livelihood, and some things regarded as wrong livelihood, such as trade in weapons, trade in poisons, trade in animals, trade in human beings, and trading in meat. These are all regarded as wrong livelihood. But generally, as well as that, I think that in that sphere of economic activity, actually things have changed a huge amount since the time of the Buddha, obviously. And there are many kinds of jobs which exist today which didn't exist in the Buddha's day, right? And so, generally speaking, we should consider any kind of livelihood that causes harm, right, to be wrong livelihood. But then that's a very difficult thing to evaluate, because pretty much anything causes some harm. Right? Even just breathing in and out. You breathe in oxygen, you breathe out carbon dioxide. You're contributing to global warming. Okay, so unless you've got a job that requires you to be in fourth jhana constantly for the whole job, then you're going to be breathing, so you're going to be doing some harm. So obviously we have to kind of do a balance of the harm and the good. In the previous session we had some discussion with Viluni. I mean, she's a student, it was not her job technically, but about her kind of ethical dilemmas she faces in studying neuroscience and so on. And so we have, we always will face those difficulties, right, whatever path we're going down, whatever job we're doing. It's rarely going to be clear cut, yeah. But we can try our best to find some kind of way of livelihood that's going to be productive and useful and actually help people. Yeah? And some of the best kinds of livelihood we can have is being a doctor, or somebody who's going to help people that way. A teacher is good livelihood. Yeah? But really anything which is actually helping people, you know, like being a carpenter is right livelihood, yeah, because, well, people need homes to live in and they need furniture to sit on. So you need somebody to make those things. We should always be grateful for that. Being a plumber is right livelihood, you know, supplying water for people can clean themselves and drink fresh water. You know, being a sweeper is right livelihood, yeah. All of those simple jobs which are often regarded as not very high status, but you can see that actually they actually make a genuine contribution, and we can't live without people doing those things. Eh? On the other hand, there's a lot of jobs which are a bit more kind of nebulous, and you're thinking, can we survive reasonably well on this planet without them? So, for example, like an advertising executive, for example. is that right livelihood, right? A financial advisor telling for someone how to invest on the sort of short-term stock markets or something like that. Are these forms of right livelihood? I don't know. What do you reckon? So I think one of the big problems we have, I think we have today a lot of kinds of livelihood which do cause harm. But I think in addition to that, I think perhaps a big shift since the Buddha's day, really, with livelihood. The biggest shift, I don't think, is towards livelihood that has harm, because I think there are different cases both now and the Buddha's day. I think the biggest difference now is that towards livelihood that lacks meaning. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And I think we're so much more specialized, so much more distanced, so much more abstracted from any real world case where these things might apply, that it's very easy to spend your whole life, you know, just sitting in some cubicle and, you know, filling out some kind of forms or filing something or doing some kind of IT project or job and so on, and you never actually see any connection between what you're doing and the real world. Even if what you're doing is intrinsically a good thing, you might be doing administration for a hospital or something like that, right? But you don't actually see the connection between what you're doing and what the result is. Whereas with traditional work, then almost always you see that. You know, you're a farmer, you plant the seed, the rice either grows or it doesn't. And you know, that's a great feeling. And I've never been a farmer, but before I was a monk, you know, you'd grow a few veggies in the back garden or something like that. And what a fantastic feeling it is, right, to grow a few vegetables or something, and then, oh, we can cook it and you can eat it. It's so special. Do you feel that satisfaction that you've done something and it's meaningful? And I think that's something that's very, very hard, both because of the nature of the work, it's more specialized, more abstracted, but also I think because of the nature of the workplace. You know, short-term contracts, people being moved on again and again, any kind of lack of security, lack of a sense of loyalty with the company, team building and so on. And all of those mean that it's really hard, I think.